This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
James Scheck, welcome to the show. Long time coming.
G'day, Marty. It's great to be here, mate.
It's great to have you. Going to talk about a lot. I feel like we can dive into a lot of topics here. I reached out to you, though, because I'm an idiot when it comes to this cash and carry trade and how the futures markets may or may not be affecting price, particularly with the launch of the Bitcoin ETFs, which have launched with a lot of success. I think that they now collectively hold over a million Bitcoin.
Over a million, yeah. Yep. And I mean, undisputedly the most successful ETFs in history. And I just can't think of any asset that could beat it. So I think it's going to hold that record for a long time.
And I think it's just the beginning too, especially when you factor in the fact that RIAs haven't gotten the green light yet. There's a bunch of capital still waiting on the sidelines. And there could be some mechanical levers that are just unleashed where it's all right, now we need 1% of all of our clients' portfolios in Bitcoin. That could just flow into the ETFs.
And we saw that. I actually wrote a piece on this the other day because I think people get stuck not realizing how big Bitcoin is. It's simultaneously enormous and insignificant. You know, and when you look at the, I think it was Wisconsin, there's like a pension fund and they allocate 180 mil. And, you know, $180 million for us is, I mean, that's life-changing money, right? You'd never have to work again. But 180 million, they talk about it as it's 0.1% of their portfolio.
Yeah, it's 10 basis points.
It's nothing, right? And they have every expectation to move up to 1% and 2%. So you're talking about $180 million. That's 0.1% of these guys' portfolio. And then you realize that Bitcoin, and this is just a wild stat, since the FTX bottom, Bitcoin's added $1.1 trillion, which is 1.1 thousand million. Like it's these numbers are just so large. And I think we forget that it takes a lot of money to move the asset. But then you look at the bond market and the gold market and, you know, we're a fraction of that. So like they're very big numbers, but we're a small fish in a very big pond now. But relative to where we've come from, we're the biggest fish we've ever been.
Yeah. And that fish is eating too. It's going to get bigger in this big pond.
Oh yeah,
may take up a large portion of the pond.
That's
at
it.
Some point. And this is why I reach out to you, because going all the way back to 2017, December 2017, when the CME futures launched, many people, particularly in TradFi and more particularly in gold markets, said futures are launched, they're going to be manipulating the prices. Fast forward to 2024, the ETFs launch, and now that you have the ETF product, that is another liquid product that traders can leverage, and you have more people like Jim Bianco specifically, I think, coming out and saying that this is going to be used in conjunction with the futures price to sort of pigeonhole the Bitcoin price. And a lot of these commentators are saying Wall Street is now controlling the price. I've seen you've been doing analysis on this. Zero Hedge similarly hasn't been doing like deep technical analysis, but they've been tweeting every day. Looks like Jane Street's slamming the Bitcoin futures to keep the price low so the ETFs can buy cheap at the end of the day when markets close. What is going on here? You mentioned the liquidity that has come to market since 2022. How is that affecting it? What does it take to move the Bitcoin price? And how does the dynamic between the ETFs and the CME futures affect price, if at all?
Yeah, no, it's a really dynamic topic. So there's a few things I'll start with, kind of big picture. The first thing is that every asset that reaches a scale that's appreciable will develop a futures market and derivatives markets. Further to that, once you have futures markets, the cash and carry trade exists, and it exists for all assets. So first and foremost, this is a very normal thing. Now, the other one that's quite interesting is that a lot of people, I mean, from my perspective, when I look at the market so far, And again, with no kind of prediction of what comes next, it's been a very stable, quiet and trending uptrend. It's beautiful, right? We've had less than 20.4% is the deepest correction since FTX blew up. And that's astounding. And we've added $1.1 trillion since then. And, you know, even just this year, $550 billion, something like that. So it's an extraordinary rally, 18 months of up only. To be chopping around sideways like this right now makes all the sense in the world, right? Markets need to take a breather. Now, what's very interesting is that we, you know, we're trading sideways. We're consolidating after 18 months of up only. When you have 18 months of up only, you can expect very, very reasonably the consolidation to be on the order of several months. So none of this is, like, to me, none of it is surprising. Now, it's interesting that people come out and say, oh, look, it's market manipulation. Now, first things first, market manipulation and like in the sense of gold absolutely happens, right? Let's not kid ourselves. It absolutely happens. But just because the price is going sideways doesn't mean the market's being manipulated the way that gold is, right? What it usually means, if you go Occam's razor, what's the most obvious reason for this? It's because your expectations are that we should be at 100,000. And the market doesn't care about your expectations. The market does what the market does, right? This is something that I find as an analyst. I always hold, I've been listening to you, Marty. You've got your white pill, right? Which is really important to have. It's easier to have the black pill and the white pill. Having both at the same time and say like, well, this could be a top. It could also be a consolidation, right? And always holding both of those two things and trying to assess it in a live fire exercise. As the market develops and we get this cash and carry trade, and we can talk about the mechanics of how that actually works, this has always been there since we've had futures, and they really came about in 2018. These are what you call volatility capture strategies. Now, that's the cash and carry trade in futures. It's also options. People will buy and sell options to capture volatility premiums. This is how, call it maturation of markets, right? There's options on everything. Very soon we're going to have options on the ETFs. That will happen as well. What we're basically doing is when the market goes through a range expansion, so it rallies or it goes somewhere, it could also sell off, right? It's trading from one range to another. It is always followed by a period of range contraction. So you get like an expansion of the price range, price goes somewhere else. It has to rest. It has to kind of consolidate the gains, consolidate the losses, work out what equilibrium is, and then it will move again. And during that period of time, if you just have a spot market, you'll have traders buying and selling the top of the range. That's kind of how they're capturing the volatility. As futures start to come in, there's different instruments. Some are pricing the Bitcoin out in, you know, 6 months, a year, whatever the time frame is. If they're trading at some kind of delta, this cash and carry comes in where you can kind of capture that premium between these two instruments. And with options, you've then got people who can buy and sell volatility. And what this creates is like a, think about like a collar that goes top and bottom and just sucks all the volatility juice out until the market is ready to move again. So I'll pause there. But really, to me, the thing that we haven't seen, I think there's two things. People are expecting that we should be at a different level and the market isn't adhering to their expectations, which quite frankly means your expectations are wrong. And the other one is that this volatility is like, there's like a juice to be squeezed. Once it's done, the market will move again. And usually that needs a second wave of demand to really kick things into the next gear.
Yeah, the range bound price trading over the last couple of months makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, we hit all time high before the halving for the first time ever. Obviously the ETFs were a big catalyst and drove a lot of flows at the beginning of this year, but we're up, 150% over the last 18 months, maybe more than that. And it just makes sense that we take a break. Everybody here in the U.S. is on their summer break. You have the summer doldrums setting in. People not really going to work, allocating as heavily as they do in the fall and the winter.
You're leaving it to us, to the poor Aussies down here in winter, trying to hold everything up.
You guys just had an ETF launch too, so you're trying your best.
Yeah, we did. It's funny, actually. There was a couple of people talking about it the other day too. I think it's got like 46 Bitcoin in there, right? So we're not talking about the similar scale. But at the same time, Australia's a smaller market. We tend to move much slower. So really, where's the bulk of our... Strangely enough, Australia treats the property market like you guys treat the stock market as your savings vehicle. I know, obviously, Americans use housing as well, but Australians, it's like a religion. So the housing is our thing. And really the biggest pools of capital is our 401k equivalent. So by law, you have to put 10, 12% in. And that's kind of where most of the money goes into the stock market. And until they're allowed into all these retirement platforms, really it's just hodlers basically buying Bitcoin with whatever cash they got spare, but most of them are just going to buy a spot. So it's always going to be smaller until those rails get turned on.
Yeah, that's good to know. Did you hear,
the
you
cool thing about the Aussie one, though, the Monochrome, is you can actually withdraw. So if you've got coins in the ETF, you can actually withdraw, which is pretty cool.
Which is good to see, a good precedent to see. Because I know some of the ETF issuers here in the United States, I think they wanted it initially. The SEC gave them comments, said no, cash in, cash out. But I do know, won't name anybody particularly, but I do know some of the ETF operators here are making it a point over the next couple of years to try to get those in-kind redemptions, because that's the way it should be. It's tax advantaged. It is also a mechanism to force these ETF issuers and Coinbase to make sure they actually have the Bitcoin sitting under the ETF. And so I think it makes sense. And I actually think there's a good argument to be made if the fiscal and monetary mishandling here in the United States persists and inflation gets out of hand, it'll actually be demanded, where people will say, I don't want the cash, I want the Bitcoin.
Well, we've seen many instances over the last, let's say, 2 years, many, many cases where the market has demanded something, and whether it be politicians, regulators, whatever it is, the degree of bending the knee of late has been quite fascinating. It's important, obviously, not to become complacent, because, you know, this whole concept of the goldification, it's a real risk, right? And we'll probably come back to the cash and carry side, but it's a real risk. But at the same time, it's, you know, we have seen a lot of concessions get made. Bitcoin has forced that kind of bending of the knee in many ways. And I think that's just another example, right? Over time, the market will demand the in-kind, and, you know, it feels like a matter of time, and the ETF issuers know it.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network, and you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and their rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com.
And on that point, back to the cash and carry trade, what do people like Jim Bianco, who believe that the cash and carry trade is being used to suppress the Bitcoin price, in your mind, what are they missing, or how are they assessing the situation wrong, essentially?
Yeah. So I'm not even sure that Jim's got down to that level of nuance. I've been pretty disappointed with Jim's commentary, to be honest, because usually he's pretty sharp and he's a numbers guy, right? So I respect his views a lot. But on the ETFs, it's just been, it's like being his kryptonite. He just hasn't had good takes on it, in my opinion. So I think the main chart people have probably seen floating around is, I think, Zero Hedge, right? As they would do, just share this enormous short position that's been building in CME futures. Now, I've actually been tracking the CME because they're now bigger than Binance. So Binance was the market leader in terms of futures open interest for a very long time. And through 2023, probably about halfway through, CME actually flipped Binance. So there's two things that happened in 2023 that are quite meaningful in the derivatives world. The first one is that CME became bigger than Binance. And then we also saw options. So Deribit remains the biggest platform for options. Options in open interest also reach the same level of futures, and they used to be like 10%. So options are a much more sophisticated instrument. It allows a lot more hedging and risk management and things like that. So both of these two things, CME and options growing, really speaks to an institutionalization. We have a different set of actors in the market today. Now, the other thing that I've had floating around, which I'll just kind of put out there before we jump into the technicals of the cash and carry, is we haven't had a 20% correction. And when you look at the sell side volume and like the maker-taker behavior inside spot markets, disproportionately sell side. So what does that tell you? We've got a sophisticated set of actors. We've seen CME growing, options are growing, and the market has seen mostly net sell side on the in spot markets, and yet we haven't had a more than 20% correction. That feels to me like patient buyers who let the market come to them, right? The average pleb, most of them probably hit smash buy, right? We just go market buy and just take off the books. Most of the guys who've been acquiring, like when we're talking about these kind of these metrics, they're just sitting there allowing the market to come to them. They're patient. They're just allowing the market to do its thing and they're not forcing in either direction. So this feels like more institutional adoption, right? So that's kind of the big picture backdrop. Now, in terms of the short position, so there's a few things to look at. No question, in the first like 3 months after the ETFs launched, the ETF inflows were massive and by and large, true demand inflows, right? Lots of people buying, looks like retail. Jim Bianco had the point that, oh, it's retail, they're going to paper hand it as soon as we have some kind of sell-off. Well, we had the sell-off, and I put out a video just a couple of weeks before that. So in the world of Bitcoin, and particularly the on-chain world, shrimp are actually the smart money. And you can see there's a chart that I've shared a few times, but it looks at the amount that the shrimps balance, how many coins the shrimp have, and when they bought heavily. They bought heavily into the 2017 top. That was me. I like literally bought the absolute top. You couldn't have bought higher than me. And then the explosion in Bitcoin education from 2017 through to 2020, like by the time we get to 2022 and FTX is blowing up, the shrimp actually know what they own. They're serious, serious hodlers, right? How many podcasts are these people listening to? Like I know myself, right? I put myself in the bucket. I'm shrimp in scale, but I probably understand Bitcoin better than most people in Wall Street, right? So you've got this very, very interesting dynamic where the shrimp are actually not the dumb money. So Jim has this perspective that they're going to paper hand it and they're going to sell on the dip. Well, it's like these guys actually bought on the 20, like at the FTX bottom, when the narrative is that Bitcoin is dead for a decade, these guys stepped in and bought in size bigger than 2017. And then they actually sold into the ETF rip. And then we saw this kind of correction and consolidation. I'm like, retail may not be as dumb as you think, Jim. Like, and when I think about who's going to be the early adopters of Bitcoin ETFs, it's going to be hodlers who've already got a bunch of spot. And they're like, well, I've got this 401k. Now I can put that in as well. Like these are people who are buying because they know what they own. Over time, we will get a dispersion. But to me, it just feels like hodlers are still in play. Now, when we get this record short position, right, in the CME, in the early days of the ETF, the first 3 months, I ran a study that looks at how much the CME open interest changed. So think about this like people opening positions. And let's just assume, just real back of the envelope math, let's just assume everything is a short position, right? Every open interest is some guy shorting it, as people are claiming. Now, naturally, there's someone who has to be buying that as well, but you know, people kind of forget that neutral side of the equation. Let's imagine every uptick in CME open interest is some guy smashing the short sell. So I compared CME open interest to the ETFs, to the inflows. And what I basically found is that in the early days, the ETFs were massive, like 3 or 4 times larger than CME open interest changes. So as a result, that's just net inflow. People are just buying the spot ETFs, cash is going in, number go up. As we go through the correction, and particularly over the last, say, that month and a half, the ETF inflows, and we saw like a $2 billion week the other day, these ETF inflows are pretty much at the exact same scale as CME open interest changes. So in other words, every dollar that's going into the ETFs is being matched by an increase in our very simple model of a short seller in the CME. So you're like, okay, that looks like these two things are correlated. You've got someone buying ETF and shorting futures. Now, this has been happening in the Bitcoin market for years with the funding rates. Funding rates are just literally a perpetual, it's a future that never expires. There's a premium where you can buy spot Bitcoin today and sell it technically in the future. That's what futures are. You can buy it today and sell it in the future. If you buy Bitcoin at 60K and you sell it in the future at 70K, all you have to do is wait until that future date, right? What is the date of that expiration? You've already bought the spot and now you're selling it at 70K. Over the course of that time, the two prices will converge. You collect the premium. So what I looked at is what is the futures prices? And what we see is that there's about a 10% premium. So what that meant out to December. So that means I can buy, if I'm Wall Street, I can buy it an ETF, which is spot Bitcoin. I buy a dollar worth of Bitcoin and I sell $1.10 worth of Bitcoin for delivery in December. And as long as I hold those two positions open until December, I will lock in a 10 cent profit, right? 10%. That is essentially what the cash and carry trade is. And the reason why this premium exists is because people are betting with leverage on the long side in futures. People are literally saying, I believe that the price of Bitcoin is going to be 10% higher by December. People are, there is a net long bias. And generally speaking, when people are net long, right, and you've got this kind of, it's going to go up forever, it's usually the sentiment where it's probably not going to go up forever. So like, that's why this consolidation happens. When nobody believes it's going to go up, that's when there's not going to be enough premium for this strategy to work, right? And all these positions will slowly unwind. And then there'll be that there won't be that kind of equal and opposite arb strategy. And then the market's free to move again.
And so with this particular cash and carry, people are looking at, so what I'm trying to hone in on here too, and obviously Zero Hedge has been pointing at Jane Street specifically, but retail investors, institutions, getting Bitcoin exposure via the ETF. You see the daily flows at the ETFs. Is then somebody external of these ETF issuers looking at those flows and making this trade? Or is it somebody within BlackRock, within Fidelity, who's trying to increase their revenue by deploying this strategy based off of the inflows from their clients?
No, I think this is, it's even simpler than that. You're a hedge fund. You don't own Nvidia, so you're getting killed. You're getting killed in the market right now. You're underperforming. What do you do? Well, I could trade Bitcoin, right? I could own that, but now it's not going up. So there's not those kind of easy wins. There was no question. There would have been some hedge funds who just like jumped in on the Bitcoin ETF launches and rode that extra wave higher. But if you think about it, right, the risk-free rate right now is 5% from treasuries. If you can get 10% by literally buying spot and simultaneously, like literally the same day, buy spot, sell future, and you can just sit and wait and get 10%, you're doubling the risk-free rate. And this is effectively a no-risk trade, right? The only risks in this trade is essentially that like the ETF issuer blows up, the futures exchange blows up, you stuff up your margin. Like really, if we take away all the counterparty risk, which TradFi doesn't care about because that's all they ever have, take away the counterparty risk because that's a default. If you remove that, this is basically risk-free. And this isn't like a Rao Powell basically risk-free. This is like an actual risk-free. You're buying an asset today. You've already sold it in December for the future. In the future, you deliver it in December. So as long as you hold the Bitcoin or the ETF until December, and then what they do is they roll it. So let's say this premium still exists. And by the way, eventually there'll be ETFs that do this, that literally they buy spot and they'll sell the future and they'll close it in and then they'll roll it. They'll close out the position, buy the ETF, roll it out to the next contract, right? So they just keep rolling the future out and out and they collect this 5, 10, 15, 5, whatever the premium is over time. And this is literally what funding rates do. And here's probably an important element to all of this. In perpetual markets, the funding rate is basically exactly the same mechanism, except instead of being like a fixed, I buy and sell it and that's my premium, it's going to be fixed as long as I hold it. The funding rate actually moves with the market. So every 8 hours, it's essentially reassessing what your new interest rate is. This brings liquidity, because these guys can essentially come in and provide sell side or buy side. They keep the market kind of structured and in place. They deepen liquidity. So it's generally speaking, it's a neutral strategy in terms of like impact on the market. It's because you've got a buy and a sell. And if you didn't have a buy and a sell, you've probably got a sell and a buy. So like these things kind of balance themselves out. But what they do is they bring deeper liquidity, right? They bring more and more people so that if you do have to put on a position in size, you've actually got the books to deal with it, right? There's enough liquidity there and these market makers are being incentivized by a delta neutral strategy to bring volume, open interest, trade volume, like just overall liquidity to the market. So It's part of the maturation process. Some people will say it's manipulation, but by and large, it's like, I was thinking about this just before the call. The problem with paper gold isn't the open interest, not the futures market, because futures markets will always exist. They're just a part of a maturing market. The problem with gold is unallocated gold, right? Because you've got these gold bars that you can't actually verify there. You can't really have unallocated Bitcoin because it's either in the wallet or it's not. There's not really like, oh, is it tungsten? I don't know. Is it like actually like got a serial number? None of this shit matters. For Bitcoin, you can't really have unallocated Bitcoin. You can have people betting on the side, like a bucket shop style cash settled futures. That's fine. That's separate. That's just like the people who are buying a cash settled future probably aren't buying spot anyway, right? That's a gamble. That's a bet. That's different style of market. Whereas in the unallocated gold space, they're selling physical gold, but there's no actual physical gold there, right? For Bitcoin, your node's telling you the Bitcoin's there or it's not.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores. Connect your wallets or custodial accounts and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off.
And so you don't think there's any rehypothecation going on?
Look, I've seen a lot of people saying that Coinbase is rehypothecating. I see a lot of people saying that the ETFs are rehypothecating. Look, as it stands, having looked at the balances, right? Data scientists are tracking this kind of stuff. The balances for the ETFs are there. There are coins there. Coinbase is a multi-billion-dollar company. And this is the same reason that I'm very skeptical when people are like, oh, this multi-billion-dollar business that's making a absolute gargantuan shit ton of money is going to blow up their business by breaking the law. I just don't see it, right? These guys are so regulated. And again, you know, we can go down the rabbit hole and say, well, you know, governments can get their grubby mitts and stuff in there. But like, as it stands, it just feels like an extremely low probability. What is a much higher probability is that people are assigning an expectation to the market that's unrealistic. That to me is a much more probable outcome than people worrying about rehypothecation.
Yeah, I would agree. I find it hard to believe that Coinbase would be rehypothecating, and I'm not the biggest fan of Coinbase and have not been for some time, but to think that they would kill the golden goose by doing something that's it just doesn't.
They print more money by not doing that. That's the hilarious thing. Like they actually make, like think about incentives. They're making so much money. They're making so much money. They don't need to do these hypothecation strategies to make more. Like they're already printing.
Yeah. Maybe we can touch on this later, but I don't think they're rehypothecating, but I do think all this custody concentration risk within the hands of Coinbase, getting upwards of 1 million coins in all the ETFs. Luckily, Fidelity is the second most popular ETF, so they're custodying their own coins, but hundreds of thousands of coins flowing to Coinbase. I'm more worried about the cruise missile risk of the government coming in saying, all right, here's what you're going to do with these. I don't think I still put a low probability on that, but that is a big risk. And I think custody for the ETF should be multi-institutional, multi-sig. But I think it's just too early for all these people to get comfortable with it. And obviously Coinbase doesn't have an incentive to play ball with that, considering the fact that they've accumulated a large part of the ETF market already.
Yeah. And I agree, you know, back to our previous point, I think the market will demand this over time. Right. And a lot of it's being challenged by this, you know, nuanced Saab 121 shit that the SEC's got running. Right. I mean, that prevents the banks from custodying these coins as well. And like, that's what Wall Street would prefer. They want these big institutions that they trust to go into the custody business. And I think that, you know, over time that will sort itself out. And I suspect that we will get a natural dispersion just by market forces. It feels to me like a likely outcome.
Yeah. Bringing it back to the cash and carry trade again, one thing I'm really interested to get your perspective on is with the emergence of these larger pools of liquidity, deeper markets, I have to imagine the biggest effect it has is reduced slippage. And like you mentioned, the ability for people to get in with size. Have you run the numbers at all to quantify that? Like, how big of a buy could an institution make without drastically changing the price at any given point in time?
Not specifically on that, but I have run it's back of the envelope, but with a bit more rigor than an envelope study, because a lot of people bandied around the 118x multiplier, right, that Bank of America did. And I just kept hearing this number and I was like, okay, I have to put this thing to bed. So, and this is the beauty of on-chain data, right? So for those who aren't familiar, there's a metric called the realized cap, which really is, we should be replacing the market cap with the realized cap. The realized cap is the GOAT tier metric. It is just so important. Basically, rather than valuing every coin at the spot price, we value it based on the price when it last moved. So Satoshi's coins are worth zero. Early miners are worth next to zero. However, if Satoshi sold his coins by any chance, right, they're going to get revalued from zero to 68,000 or 66,000, whatever the price is. Now, if you think about that, Satoshi acquired those coins for effectively zero. If he was to sell one of them at 66,000, someone's got to come in and buy that coin, because every seller is matched with a buyer, has got to come in and buy that coin with $66,000. So that represents a capital inflow into the market. Now, some other poor bugger is going to buy that coin at 66, market's going to sell down to 30 or 15, and he's going to bail out at a loss. So he's destroyed capital, but someone's still going to come in with $15,000 to buy that coin off him. So think about what that's describing here. If we look at it in an on-chain world, I don't particularly care about some algorithm that's buying and selling on the 1 minute chart. It's neutral. At the end of the day, they're trying to scalp a couple of dollars off here and there, and some other guy lost a couple of dollars here and there. So is that really a capital inflow, outflow? Not really, right? It's going to affect the market cap, but because it doesn't transact on chain, who cares? I'm just going to exclude that. It's not really important. So the realized cap is $580 billion today. Now, that means that if you bought your coin at 10K, you withdrew it, and you still hold it from back in 2018 or 19, you have still saved. You saved $10,000, and it's still saved at that price of $10,000. As the market moves around and coins are revalued, it's telling us that Bitcoin has absorbed $580 billion since it was its genesis, right? And that includes all the people who lost money. It includes all the people who made money, all of that combined, $580 billion. So that's the backbone. So I decided to run this study because I'm like, 118x multiplier sounds absolutely ridiculous, but let's go and have a look and just check it out. So the question is, what does demand look like? And we know what the output is, right? If you think about this like a function or a equation, how much capital had to go in to produce the change in the market cap? And I said before that the market cap since FTX is up $1.1 trillion. The market cap year to date is up $550 billion, something like that. So in order to get a $550 billion year to date change, how much money had to flow in? So I went down the rabbit hole and go, okay, let's start at the smallest number. Let's imagine that the ETFs are the only thing that drives price. Now they're not, they're something between 20 and 30% of the market, right? And that's on two fronts, by the way. GBTC is about 20-30% of long-term holder sell side. So actually people who are existing holders sold, you know, three or four times more than GBTC. And on the buy side, the ETFs, the inflows into the ETFs, about $29 billion, $30 billion in total. And the amount that the realized cap, the on-chain world has changed, is something like five or six times larger than that. So ballpark, the ETFs are something like 20 or 30% of the market. even if the ETFs are the only thing that drives the market, right? They've seen $30 billion of inflows. We've got $550 billion of market cap change. For memory, that multiplies like 30x or 15x or something, depending off you look at GBTC or not. So even if you just imagine the ETFs are the only thing moving the books, you're still at 30x generously. How the hell did Bank of America get 118x? I just can't work it out. So anyway, by my best estimate, looking at realized cap, looking at profit and loss, looking at all these different components, I came up with a multiplier that is somewhere between 4 and 6x during a bull market when coins are tight. Now, think about what this multiplier actually means. If you have a high multiplier, it actually means that coins are very scarce. And strangely enough, that's what bull markets are, because the hodlers have taken all the coins off the market. They stack them away in cold storage. The bull market gets going because there's just not enough coins at the different prices. People keep coming in. Market goes higher. You need like 20 cents to get a $1 change in the market cap. And this works in both directions, by the way. So the more people are buying and selling this thing, right, you get these periods of like a supply shortage and you get a very high multiplier. In a bear market, we actually see the exact opposite. In a bear market, basically there's a coin oversupply and you need like $5, $6, $7 to move the market cap by $1. Right. So you kind of get this multiplier effect. But what I did come to is that Bank of America says 118x. There's a bunch of commentators out there who are like, oh, 100x, 200x, 50x. You're all off by an order of magnitude. It's 5 or 6x at best. And when you are like, it's hilarious that people can believe 100x multiplier and then simultaneously blame the market for shorting and like keeping us compressed within a range. Like, you got to pick one of these dynamics, folks.
So right now we're sitting at 3.87, I believe, I'm seeing on the chart.
Yep. Yeah, this is exactly right. So this is an oscillator. I've got upper and lower bound here because obviously everything's a bit of a range. But as you can see on the right-hand axis, right, the highest that we've ever got to, ever, fleetingly, very briefly, is 8x, right? So that basically means that every dollar that goes in, you get an $8 change in the market cap in both directions. You can see it happen in FTX. That's like an illiquidity to the downside, but then you've also got an illiquidity to the upside. Most of the time, it's illiquidity to the upside. And this is another fun kind of narrative. People like, oh, Bitcoin's too volatile. It's like, well, first of all, its volatility is in line with most of the stocks in the S&P 500 at the moment. But second of all, it's volatile during bull markets, right? So volatility is actually good because it's heading higher by and large.
Yeah, it's when you see the bands furthest away from each other, just looking at the chart now.
Correct.
Yeah, the Bank of America. Yeah, look, the way I understand the Bank of America, the way I understand the Bank of America analysis is they didn't really factor in historical data, and they were just using like the most recent data and be like, oh, it's 186.
And the other thing is that when you look at the paper, it was like the absolute top in like March or April 2021. So like they're producing this report, and to be fair to them, I can't tell whether they actually did a lot of work to it. They basically said that a $93 million inflow, which is a very specific number to use as your baseline, a $93 million inflow would create a 1% change in the market cap. And when you back out what that 1% change is, it was, you know, billions of dollars, and that was where they got 118x. So to me, they probably looked at the Coinbase order book, and they who knows how they actually measured it. But when you put even a little bit of rigor to it, which on-chain data is fantastic at doing, you just get to a number that's like, okay, let's just kind of constrain ourselves, folks. We're probably between 3 and 5x. And if you use that number, you're much more realistic.
It's not a bad number either. I mean, it's obviously not over 100.
It makes sense. Like gut feel, it feels like it's, you know, within the ballpark. And the fact that multiplier was consistent through history, you know, and that's just basing it off the changes in the realized cap. How much does some guy need to inject into the market relative to the market cap change? That to me feels pretty real.
Yeah. The higher multiplier effect numbers are they're great engagement farming tools.
Oh, and this is the battle that we analysts face all the time, is that the engagement, same as whales, right? If I can leave audience with a couple of things, first things first, anyone who's talking about 100x multiplier, ignore them, because they just aren't. And I've shared this report far and wide. If they're not reading it and listening to it, then can't help them. The other one, stop whale watching. Every time someone posts some chart being like, look, whales sold 50,000 Bitcoin. If whales sold 50,000 Bitcoin, we would not be at $66,000, first things first. The problem with whale metrics is if you're looking at are you looking at a whale or are you looking at a Coinbase or a Binance cold wallet? Because if you're looking at a whale, they sold 50,000 Bitcoin. But if you're looking at a exchange, they moved 50,000 Bitcoin. But where do they move it? They probably moved it into custody or a cold wallet. And like buying by a whale is actually selling by others. Like it's literally 180 degrees reverse. Whale watching in the world of Bitcoin is a sport people love to do. The alpha in it is zero. And I've spent a long time trying to work out whether there's alpha in it. There is not. So folks who are doing whale watching, I'd strongly recommend not doing it, because unless you are actually in the Bitcoin node and you are doing the data science yourself, you're probably looking at an anomaly. You're probably looking at a hot wallet becoming a cold wallet. You're probably looking at whoever your data provider is, their algorithm hasn't caught up to that particular event. It's just so noisy that it's not worth, even if you think you're right, you're probably wrong. So therefore, the probability that it's not worth using is high.
Yeah, it's a combination of that, or it is an early Bitcoin or moving Bitcoin, but most of it is going to a change address that they control.
Exactly. It's a consolidation. It's a custody account. There's all sorts of things. Now, to be fair, there are some things, like when you see, same with exchange outflows, right? People love to look at exchange outflows. Most of the exchange outflows that we've seen of late, and everyone's like, look, balances are all-time low. It's like, yes, Coinbase is moving it from their exchange wallet to their custody wallet. Now, true, that is demand by someone. Could be ETFs, could be an institution. There's all sorts of people. But it's still inside Coinbase. It's like it's still part of the Coinbase entity. Yeah, there's some guys who are withdrawing, but for the most part, you're looking at internal wallet shuffling.
Yeah, it's going from Coinbase trading to their Zappo, Coinbase custody.
Exactly.
And you've been in the on-chain analysis game for quite a while now, in Bitcoin terms, many years.
Yeah.
Quite a while.
It's been around for 6 years, and I've been in it for about 6 years.
And so let's dive into this subject, because it's infinitely fascinating, because you have, obviously, the order books on the exchanges, the prices on many exchanges across the world, and then you can couple it with this on-chain data, which is specific to Bitcoin, and in terms of a treasure trove of data for analysts like yourself, the fact that the ledger is public is an innovation, not only for the peer-to-peer digital cash system and using it as a currency, but also analyzing the system. And so in your mind, becoming as prolific as of an on-chain analyst as you have over the years, what does the on-chain data do for somebody in your position? Like, how does it change the game in terms of...
Yeah.
Following these assets and doing reports and trying to educate the market about what's actually happening.
Absolutely. So my background is civil engineering, right? So as an engineer, I like to understand how things work. It's about the mechanics of the system. And back when I was at university, I think it was like my very first lecture. He goes, all right, you're all in a civil engineering degree. About 30% of you are going to end up in finance. And I was like, a joke. And here I am, right? One of the 30% who ended up in finance. Now, granted, Bitcoin is a special type of finance, but and the more I've pondered why he said this and why this was the case, it's because engineers come in with it. We don't get taught economics. We don't get taught how the business system works. What we get taught is to think about like what matters, what's the governing factor in a problem. We get taught problem solving. And we look at the economy, or I certainly do. I look at it a lot more like a machine. I'm looking for what are the big causes? What are the big effects? How do we link them together? And I don't get too bogged down in the details, because generally speaking, the like back of the envelope will get you between plus or minus 10, 20% of the answer. If that answer is close enough, then press on, right? And particularly for me, my background was in called geotechnical engineering, which is dealing with the ground. And the ground is unlike structures where you get to put steel and concrete wherever you want, the ground gives you whatever the fuck Mother Nature gives you. That's it. You just get whatever the ground is there. And it's a very different game, right? If you've got to excavate a basement for a building or a train station or something, you may get 0.0001% of the material that you've got to make a decision off. So lots of incomplete information, lots of risk, lots of probability, and your design or your market thesis has to be very flexible. You can't have a single piece of information come out and it completely blows out your thesis, because otherwise your building's going to fall down. You need to be very, very flexible to this stuff. So that's how my how I became attached to markets, because that probability side was fascinating. Now, on-chain data, as you mentioned, it's basically like Bitcoin's a big database. At the end of the day, it's an append-only, you know, you can't reverse the history. Big spreadsheet of who owned what and when. But also, which is a really important element, Bitcoin is very grassroots, right? It came from the hodlers, and the hodlers are just retail guys, right? But just people out in the world. They're not Wall Street. We're only just getting into the Wall Street world today. We're talking about a very grassroots and also a very emotional asset. There is no asset in history that more people love, hate, fear, and revere than Bitcoin. I don't know why it is, but it brings out the best and the worst in everybody. And it's a very emotional thing. Now, what's beautiful about this, and the same reason that price charts in the 1920s look exactly the same as price charts today, is because our brain hardware, the ape that we still are, has not changed in, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. We are the same ancient hardware dealing with new problems. So what Bitcoin's like very emotional grassroots kind of behavior pattern is that it's baked our psychology. And you can go and read like Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. You can go and read Trading in the Zone, any of these books that talk about like how you as a market participant think. Human beings are trained to lose in markets because we're taught to avoid risk, and markets are all about risk. So what happens is people make the exact wrong decision at the exact wrong time. You've probably experienced it yourself where you literally buy, it sells off like literally immediately. You think, oh shit, it keeps going down. Then eventually you go, okay, that's it, it's going lower. And you sell, and then of course it rallies right back to your cost basis. You go, oh man, that sucks. You buy again, then it sells off again. This is what human beings are like by default designed to do. Now, as a result, this database that is Bitcoin is full of the most emotive, core, fundamental human psychology that you can imagine. And if you think about what you're looking for, right? If I'm in a bull market, when do I not want to buy? When it, like if I want to just do a DCA strategy, I don't particularly want to buy when all the guys who bought 2.5 years ago at the bottom are selling and taking fat profits, because that's probably going to oversaturate the market at some point in time. I want to wait when the guys that they sell to, the slightly less experienced, slightly dumber money, I want to see when they buy those coins, and I'm going to wait until they capitulate and sell. They buy high and they sell low. I want to buy when they sold low, because now I'm getting Bitcoin. I want to buy Bitcoin as cheap as I can, but knowing that it's going up forever, Laura. So essentially, I want to improve my cost basis. I don't want to pay too much of a premium, but I'll pay a bit of a premium. But I want to see when the guys who paid a big premium sell low. So, and this works at all different levels, but ultimately, Bitcoin is such an emotive database. It is full of us operating on our ancient hardware at scale. We behave as a herd. And you can see the herd moving. You can also see when the smart money take profits into that herd. And it's not just the world of on-chain, because you've got on-chain ticking over. It's like basically the description of the spot market. And by the way, I am 100% positive that if gold had a blockchain, you'd see this. If bonds had a blockchain, you would see this. You would be able to see all of these transactions. You'd also see all the manipulation and shit going on as well. But Bitcoin, because of just the way it is, it's like a perfect lens into human market psychology. And we combine that with futures, ETFs, spot order books, whatever it is, because the Bitcoin market is obviously dynamic, but the on-chain is like this big piece of glue that connects them all together. It's like the connective tissue of data that goes between the ETFs, goes between the exchanges, between the futures markets. So to me, it's just endlessly fascinating.
In your view, what are some of the most high signal on-chain data points that you use on a day-to-day basis?
Yep. So basically, if I was going to point people to two metrics, it's going to be MVRV and SOPA. And they stand for, MVRV is the market value to realized value. Probably a lot of people have seen it. The best way to think about these two metrics, they're actually siblings. When I look at on-chain data, and actually on my website, if you check on-chain, you'll see there's a button called the on-chain on-chain framework. Basically, that one there, I've got, I split up the market and how you like describe data into different axes. One side is, are the coins moving? Are they unspent? Are they coins that people still hold? And MVRV describes how much profit or loss people are in, right? This is it. This is it here. So basically, imagine that big cube is the Bitcoin supply. And what I'm going to do is split it up into three different axes. The x-axis is, are the coins moving or not? And on any particular day, 1% of the supply kind of transacts. A lot of that's like the same coin transacting more than once. But the on-chain volume is about 1% of the total supply. So you've then got, are those coins in profit or in loss, right? You've got people who are holding coins. Are they up? Are they down? Are they at break even? People who are spending coins, are they taking a profit? Are they taking a fat L? Are they at break even? MVRV and SOPA describe those two buckets. Show me whether people are in profit or loss based on the coins they hold. And think about this, right? Every hodler, and I don't care how diamond-handed you are, if you keep ratcheting your unrealized profit, the amount of like portfolio green you are, from 100% to 200% to 400 to 500 to 1,000 to 10,000, at some point, maybe not you, but some other guy is going to sell. I don't care. Like at some point, some other guy is going to sell. And eventually that sell side overwhelms the inflowing demand. So MVRV is telling you how in profit or in loss is the market. At bull market peaks, you generally get to like MVRVs of 3 or 3.5. This means everyone's up 250%. Someone's going to sell. At bear market bottoms, you've got massive unrealized losses. Who can actually carry those unrealized losses? Only the hodlers, right? Only the hardcore hodlers can actually carry those losses. You have wiped out all the speculators. They are gone. SOPA is the system metric. So I can see that everyone's in profit from a high MVRV value, but are they actually taking it? Because the taking of those profits is actually what puts a top in. Because unless people are selling, we just keep gapping higher until we find a liquidity pool. SOPA is telling you, you just hit that liquidity pool. People are now selling, they're taking chips off the table. And when people are worried about why the market's not rallying, like right now, it's because long-term holders are still locking in this like base level of profit. They're still taking chips off the table. Granted, much less than they were, but SOPA is telling you when people are actually taking profits, and you'll see it. SOPA will have these enormous negative prints below one at bottoms. You can see like that's a bear market. That's a bear market. That is a capitulation. When it goes, it goes. And we actually released a report back in, I think it was, we label everything by weeks, but week 46, 2022, which is when FTX blew up. And we saw this just enormous red candle on SOPA. And my colleague basically wrote that in every instance where we've ever seen this, it was the ultimate point of capitulation. And of course, that was the exact bottom.
Yeah. And I thought I put the SOPA chart in there. Here it is, Logan. So we pulled that up to see it. It's fascinating. I am one of the monkey brained Bitcoin holders. I typically just accumulate and smash buy every market bottom, every market top.
And yep.
I always, at some point in the cycle, I'm like, all right, maybe I should look at on-chain metrics, but fail to do so. But the data that you've accumulated and present on your site, checkonchain.com, go to charts.checkonchain.com to check out all these charts. It's something I got to utilize more.
Basically, if you look at SOPA, and in particular, we look at short-term holders, short-term holder, SOPA, and MVRV, it's very simple. If you're a hodler, buy as low as you possibly can, short-term MVRV, short-term SOPA, because the lower they are, the more likely we're at a dip, or if we're in a bear market, you're buying at the points of absolute capitulation, right? So just using short-term SOPA and short-term MVRV to buy as low as you can. Don't buy when it's high, because that's telling you that people are in and about to or are taking profit. And you probably don't want to buy when some other guy who's been around for a lot longer is selling into that rally.
Yeah, and so I'm looking at the SOPA chart right now. It looks like the 22 FTX capitulation was the lowest since 2015. So that was probably the best opportunity.
That's what we call the single cycle hodlers. They buy at the top in 2021. They hodl, they hodl, they hodl. They get to the absolute bottom and they go, I'm done. I'm out. I can't deal with this anymore. And they sell everything. We see it every single cycle. That's those poor guys who bought the highest, selling the lowest. That's the bottom tick. And it's funny because you look at, you know, you may get phone calls or, you know, you've got kind of like the social proof. Gee, it feels pretty bearish out here. And then you look at on-chain metrics and you're like, and it looks pretty bearish here. I got to be a contrarian. I got to step in.
Yeah. What do you think this data is going to do for Wall Street analysts? Are you privy to any
treasure trove?
Are you privy to any institutional investors who are on top of this and get it, or do you think it's still a bit foreign to them?
So it's both. So first things first, some of the names who have come into this space, you know, they're doing this thing over, they're saying this thing over here, but they're then doing this thing over here and actually getting deep into the data. There's also a lot of commentary where people are like, oh, you know, I don't, it's public data, so therefore there can't be any alpha in it. And I can't even begin to tell you how much work I've tried to put into convincing firms that, like, guys, this is why I write the reports and make the videos. I'm like, I know the alpha's there. And first things first, no one understands it. This is so untapped. It's unbelievable. And the funny thing is, like, you know, some people use it for trading. Some people use it for what I do, which is a bit more macro scale, like understanding the mechanics. I just want to understand why. I want to know why things happen. But why it's so consistent. And it's been like, I came into the 2021 cycle and I hold this view today. At some point in time, these metrics will break. And I'm constantly looking for when those metrics break. And suffice to say that the times when I've assumed they were broken and acted accordingly have actually been the times when I've been the most wrong. So in a very strange way, I'm always looking out for why these things will break and change. They just don't seem to break. Until they break, I'm going to keep trusting them as they work, with one eye, keeping an eye out for when they start to fail. But so far, they just seem to work. So I think Wall Street will get there. They're a long way off at the moment, but there's some early movers, and some of those early movers are pretty serious characters. Some distance away from broad scale adoption.
What would convince you that these models are broken?
So it's a great question. One is, I was starting to look at these ETFs, right? So obviously you've got these ETFs and then it's like you've got trade volume off book. And it's like, okay, well, that's going to be a factor. So I started really thinking about this. And we've actually seen I came to this conclusion, which is a bit kind of left of field, but we've actually seen these ETFs happen at least twice before in the past. I would argue potentially three times. What are ETFs? They are a big pool of capital where coins go off-chain, essentially. They're held in some big custodial wallet. And then there's a whole lot of trading activity that happens beyond that, right? So my base assumption is that thus far, on-chain metrics just continue to work. They just do. At least from my perspective, they continue to work. So that's my core assumption. When have we seen a big pool of capital that takes Bitcoins offline and then there's a bunch of trading that goes off book? That probably has some kind of an impact in market. Well, 2017, with the launch of exchanges and Binance and shitcoin trading, that was kind of that, wasn't it? There was a big pool of capital that pulled coins off book and there's a bunch of trading going on. Then we saw it again in 2019, where we went from like 4K to 14K. And that was because Plus Token Ponzi, which absorbed like 2% of all the Bitcoin in like 3 months in China, that also is a big pool of like spot-driven demand that's sucking coins off-chain, putting them into some single wallet. So we kind of saw ETF number one back in 2019. It just happened to be a Ponzi scheme. We then saw GBTC in 2021, which was a big pool of capital that pulled coins off chain. A bunch of people were trading. Like GBTC was ETF V2. We saw the ETFs happen in 2021. And here we are with the spot ETFs. And granted, they're not a Ponzi scheme. Well, thus far, they're not a Ponzi scheme. They're not a closed end fund that, you know, was rorting their customers. Here we are with, you know, a free market, you know, as best as it can be in Wall Street, a free-ish market of choose your ETF. And we're going to buy and sell coins and they'll flow in and out. We've seen the second or the third, however you want to measure it, fourth pool of capital that pulls coins off chain and they keep moving around, right, in trade volume. So that was a thing I was trying to pay attention to and look for it. Really, the way that Bitcoin, that on-chain data stops working for Bitcoin is we end up in a world where everything happens off chain And as an analyst, that just means I have to expand and say, well, okay, well, if it's all happening on Lightning, which is a very, very low probability, but if it all happened on Lightning, then we've got to start mapping what the Lightning Network's doing and combining it with like settlement in and out. And, you know, it's the same way that the economy, if you want to analyze the economy, you use relatively broad brush metrics, right? You're not measuring every individual business. You're getting a broad brush view. There's error bars around stuff, but by and large, directionally, you can generally get pretty close. So as long as people are still transacting on chain, in my opinion, we'll still be able to use this stuff for many, many years to come. And of course, it will evolve and analysts just have to evolve alongside it, which is, you know, that's part of the fun for me. It keeps it dynamic.
In what area of on-chain data do you think's most underutilized or that you're really interested in exploring more and digging into and trying to maybe create new metrics, new multiples?
Oh, yeah. So my favorite area by far is, you saw on that previous chart, the Axis profit and loss. Because at the end of the day, what drives us to make decisions? Profit and loss. It's just the nature of the beast. Investors respond to their P&L. You may not as a hodler, but some other guy does. And if you're not selling, someone else will. So looking at people's unrealized profit, here's if we're like people say, what's your price target for the top? When's the top going to happen? And my answer is always the same. First of all, I got no idea and I don't know. But show me the mechanics and I'll tell you what's the top. So what does a top really look like at the most fundamental level? Too many people buying too many coins, too high of a price. That's what actually puts a top in. Usually the characteristics of those people is they're less experienced. They heard about Bitcoin on the news. They bought Bitcoin for the first time. And the sellers have been around for 6 years, 7 years, 8 years. They know what's up. They bought low. They're selling high. So what happens if people are realizing and locking in profit the whole way up? People are then buying and buying and their cost basis is going higher and higher. What does a top look like? It's when price sells off just a little bit below their cost basis. And you get this cascade of fear and panic. And then one guy's sell becomes another guy's stop loss. And then you get this, like, that's what precipitates a bear. So what I'm looking at, and it's an area that I'm doing a lot of exploration in to try and understand where this top forms, I want to look at the acceleration of everyone's having a great time to now everyone's having a shit time, right? I want to see when it goes from everyone's in profit to no one's in profit. And that drop is, and you can see in this chart here, actually, the tops are clear as day. You can see that there's just this precipitous decline in people's unrealized profit and loss, falls off a cliff. That is usually where the market has now flipped over. And you have to put at least one bear market goggle on and say, well, now I'm looking for, you know, signs that the chain is starting to die and we're not getting as much activity and blah, blah, blah. There's a whole lot of mechanics here, but essentially you're looking for that, like, not much loss to some loss. And it's like interest rates going from 0.1% to 0.1%. In absolute terms, it's very small. But in relative terms, that's a 10x increase, right? You're looking for those, there's not much loss. Now there's a bit of loss. That's usually an exponential change that happens near the top.
Yeah. And so just by eyeballing that chart, it seems like we have a bit more consolidation to go. Maybe a bit
more. Yeah. Right now, I characterize the market in bulls, quiet and trending, which is where we rally, we go sideways. We rally, we go sideways. Very stable. Very, very stable, very mature price action. 2021 was not that. If you go back and look at 2021, we just went straight up. There was no support built and we filled in that circle on the way back down, right? So 2021 built absolutely no support and we paid the price for that. Right now, we are building support at 30K. Then at 40K, then at 50K, then at 60. We're literally stair-stepping higher. Once we really get going, we move into the volatile and trending. And this is very commodity-like. Most, like the stock market, there's no volatility when it heads higher because it's like a manipulated straight line. But with Bitcoin, it gets volatile on the way higher. So once we move into that volatile phase, that's when you're in the euphoric period. And in my opinion, that's when there's a timer. Right now, I don't think there's a timer on this bull. If we just kept doing it, we could keep doing this forever. It just could keep going higher. But at some point, it's going to get euphoric. And once things get euphoric and people's cost bases are swinging around like crazy, you've probably been there. It's exhausting. You get tired after like 6 to 12 months.
Focus.
You're like, oh, I can't do it anymore. That's why markets get tired. People just can't do it anymore.
And
Well, on that note, like, how do you think the next 18 months play out? Obviously, we just had a halving. Maybe that's a good first question. Do you believe in the halving being a catalyst for upwards price pressure? And if so, considering the market structure now with the emergence of ETFs and options coming to market, and there'll be more options coming to market, more options ETFs, are we in a new era? Do you believe the four-year cycles of diminished returns will continue? Do you think this cycle's an anomaly compared to last? Are we going straight to a million, up forever, Laura? Or is it, in your mind, going to be very similar to cycles past?
Yeah, I mean, all great questions. So on the halving side, no question it has an impact. Is it big? No, right? I did a study a little while back where I looked at how big the halving actually is. And again, trade volume is not the perfect thing to compare it to, which a lot of people do, and I did as well. A lot of people compare it to trade volume, but technically trade volume is both directions. Halving is only sell side, but even so, when I was talking about before as an engineer, I try to focus on the things that drive, like I don't care about the 10%. Give me the 90%. The 90% factor is more important. The halving is 100 times smaller than the impact of the halving, the actual 450 coins that we booted out. That's 100 times smaller than the ETF trade volume. It's like 250 times smaller than spot trade volume, and it's 1,800 times smaller than futures volume. It's a footnote. It's like, yes, it's only sell side, but even if you whack it, 50% discount on all the other stuff, it's just not big enough to care about. So it matters, but it's not major. It's still millions of dollars coming off the market as sell side. So it's going to have an impact. It's not going to be a negative. Let's put it that way. In terms of where I kind of see the market going, I've been enjoying Jeff Ross's talk about the bull crab. I think people should get used to the bull crab. It'll go a lot more sideways now, but we're not seeing the same drawdowns. I mean, again, 20%, we normally get 25, 30, 40% corrections all the time. We've only just had a 20.4. That's the deepest we've been. So we are seeing a less volatile market. I think people are going to have to get used to a bit of boredom, because so far the market looks extremely healthy to me. There's a lot of people calling for, you know, topping patterns. I'm not seeing it yet. Obviously, always got an eye out for it, but it doesn't feel like a top here. It could be, but it doesn't feel like it yet. I've not really seen many of those things kind of cascade to the downside. So I'm still relatively constructive. I do think that over time, there's going to be more Wisconsin pension funds who are allocating 0.1%, which is more money than God. So I think you're going to start seeing this happen more and more. So the way I would describe what I think's coming, it's going to be just a slow unfolding of the passive bid. This passive bid will start to come in. The fact that it's less volatile actually makes institutions more comfortable. The bigger it gets makes them more comfortable. The more of their peers they see buying into this thing, people get more comfortable. So I think that that broad scale is going to be very constructive over the long term. You know, people get caught up on the 1 hour candle. The amount of times you see people on Twitter being like, oh, look, you know, it's dumping. And I'm looking at the price, I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean it's dumping? It's like, you know, it's within the same trade range. So people get overexcited and they over-index on the small scale. So for the most part, I think the market looks really healthy. I struggle to find, too many bear cases at this point, aside from people drawing lines on charts. And in terms of the diminishing returns, so I put basically zero weight in the concept of, oh, we went all-time high before the halving, or we can't dip below the previous cycle peak. None of this stuff really matters. Again, show me the mechanics and I'll show you the results. It's kind of the way I look at things. We could absolutely, diminishing returns, there is no law of nature that says that we have to have diminishing returns. And if I was to place a bet, it would absolutely be on, we're probably going to blow out that narrative. The four-year cycle is a more interesting one, actually, because it was the one narrative that everyone thought would die last cycle, and it was the only one that survived. So again, until it breaks, I kind of like the four-year cycle, because I think duration is a real metric, right? The time since, right? How long does it take a bear market to recover? Ultimately, that's a human psychological thing. How long does it take us to like get over the things that happened? There's also a capital component, but a lot of a duration, I think duration has a bit more semblance. So in that instance, you know, it it may well be. It may well be that the four-year cycle remains. But again, it's like on-chain. I will keep believing it's there until it fails. And I'm always half an eye on watching in case it fails.
Yeah. That does feel like this steady bull crab is materializing. And I don't mind it at all.
And no, allows you
to focus, to accumulate. You're not worried. You're not getting FOMO.
And once we get euphoric, the clock starts ticking. So in a way, the high, if you want Bitcoin to go higher, bull crabs are exactly the way you get there.
Mm-hmm. And how long does that clock tick historically once it starts ticking?
6 to 12 months. I mean, if you think about 2021, we broke high. Usually the euphoria stage happens when we break all-time high. So that would be potentially the first time that we see, let's call it like a change in market structure. Historically speaking, as we break the all-time high, you go into the euphoric phase. If we go to the next one or two legs higher and it's still quiet and trending, sideways rally, that would be a break in market structure. That would actually be like, we could be heading a lot higher than people expect. If we, on the other hand, we start to get real, like just starts ripping higher and you get this euphoric burst. And remember, that's over the medium term. You're not looking at like, oh, it's going up and it's euphoric. It's like, no, it has to be euphoric and just keep being euphoric. That would, once you get to that phase, it's like 6 to 12 months. The market usually can't keep going too much longer than that. People just get exhausted. Capital gets exhausted. It goes too high too fast. Too many people sell too many coins and too much dumb money comes in and buys too high. So, you know, that's the general frame of reference. 21, we went from, you know, December to April. I believe April was actually the all-time high. From an on-chain perspective, it's clear as day. That was the sentiment capital all-time high. The second one in November was a fake peak in many ways. But, you know, that was 5 months, 6 months. That's kind of it. You could argue November is a year, but, you know, that was kind of a strange cycle by that metric.
Yeah. And in the extension of the bull crab scenario, let's say this continues for the next year and it's a very healthy step function up into the right movement, what does that do in terms of upside potential in your mind?
He wants a price tag.
I want a price prediction.
So I come at this from, again, you know, once you get a price predictions, it's anyone's guess, but my fundamental price target as like a conservative estimate is 10.8 kilograms of gold, right? Whatever the price of 10.8 kilograms of gold is, because that's how much gold there is per coin. And that's, I mean, we all know it's going to consume gold. So that's, you know, last I checked, 1.2 million Australian. So whatever that is, 750K or something, American dollars. Now that's kind of a fundamental basis, right? How long it takes to get there, who knows? Look, I've been saying 250K, and I think 250K, it feels like it's not an egregious number. And what I was saying before about Bitcoin is big relative to us. Bitcoin is big relative to where it has been, but it's a blip. It's a blip in the grand scheme of things. So how many Wisconsin pension funds allocating 180 million, right, as 0.1%? I mean, they're looking to allocate up to 1% to 2%. Fidelity recommended a 3% portfolio. These numbers by our multiplier of 3 to 5x are enormous. Now, they're going to take a long time to happen, but when you just like, you know, spitball some numbers, 250K still puts it in the realm of like, it's still much, much, much smaller than gold, but it also is fulfilling a role that is like competitive as a neutral, sound reserve asset. I wrote a post the other day where you look at all the regulatory stuff, you look at all the capital changes, you look at the Wall Street side, you look at the ETFs. If you had to explain all of these things to me back in 2018, my head would have exploded because it's like that cannot happen. There's no way that all of these things will happen in 6 years. And yet here we are, Bitcoin is front and center in so many elements, whether it be political or otherwise. This is wild stuff. Like it is on the map now, and more people are going to want long-term allocation. So it makes all the sense in the world that, you know, 250K is still small. It's still small, but it's also enough where people are going to say, hey, that's meaningful for me. And this is probably a good point. The market has to finance Bitcoiners' lifestyles. I've been thinking a lot about this. A lot of Bitcoiners are going to be approaching the stage where they've gone from saving their proof of work to now going, oh shit, that's like a meaningful amount of money. They got to look after it now. And I think that psychological element, you're going to have to buy houses. You're going to have Bitcoiners who are going to finance families and private school. And the market is going to have to finance all of these things because that's what savings is for. Your savings is for improving yours and your family's life. That's what it's ultimately, what else is it for? So I think a lot of Bitcoiners are going to take that approach. And so they should, right? They should take their proof of work and cash it in for lifestyle chips. I wouldn't recommend the Lambo, but looking after your family and looking after yourself, absolutely, right? That's what your savings are for.
Don't waste your money on a Lambo, freaks.
Absolutely not. No, keep driving. I mean, I'm a big advocate of the Subaru, right? The engine's going to outlast me, right? Just keep thing keeps ticking over.
Get your Subarus, your Toyotas. Keep it simple.
That's it.
And I mean, in terms of Bitcoiners coming into a lot of wealth as the price goes up, that's one aspect, is cashing in the Bitcoin that you've accumulated and saved for lifestyle chips in the short to medium term. But I think I saw you write a thread and maybe an article on it as well, thinking long term in terms of generational wealth and passing it down to your children and grandchildren. That's a second order effect of this newfound wealth. Yes, obviously, you want to enjoy the fruits of your savings while you're living, but hopefully you're wise enough and conscious enough to understand that you'd like to pass them down too. And there's many things to think about in that regard, particularly how do you actually do that?
Oh, 100%. And I've been thinking about this quite a lot because, you know, it's the Bitcoiner's journey, which is my journey, right? I'm a Bitcoiner. And when you look at the demographics, it's mostly millennials, right? Millennials are the primary demographic in, I'm sure, your podcast downloads, certainly my YouTube channel. Where are millennials in their life? They're getting into the family building, home building stages. And, you know, you start thinking about your own mortality. You start thinking about, hey, you know, and I love this test. You just ask your loved ones, hey, can you spend a single transaction from my cold wallet? And what you immediately work out is like, holy shit. If I'm not there to guide them, those coins are going to somewhere in Nigeria, or they're going to get lost, or they're going to download the wrong wallet. Like, there's so many ways it can go wrong. So I've been thinking about this problem quite a bit. And, you know, you realize that my realization was that me as a Bitcoiner, I've spent a lot more time thinking about my proof of work and my coins and my security than my family had, right? And you can't expect them to just like work it out because it may not be that easy. You know, Bitcoin itself, just transacting on Bitcoin itself, to me, it's second nature. I don't think about it. But people who've not used it before got no idea, right? They're like, I don't understand what all this transaction data is, and I can't operate Sparrow Wallet. What the hell is going on here? What do you mean I have to move an SD card between this little calculator and my laptop, right? They got no chance. So, you know, just thinking about self-custody, because self-custody is super important as well by the same token. So how do you get a solution that's like self-custody, has all of the benefits of self-custody, but builds in the fail-safes? And like I eventually just had this light bulb moment where I was talking with Peter Dunworth from Bitcoin Advisor, and man, it just, the light bulb went off. I go, self-custody is a stepping stone before people start moving to some kind of collaborative custody. I feel like, and not everyone, some people, self-custody is the exact right solution for whatever stage in life you're in. But I think more and more people are going to start realizing that collaborative security is a very, very sensible option for planning in the inheritance, baking in what happens if you don't come home one day, you know, having this key security, like, you know, just talking to my mate, if he lost his keys, he just loses 5% of his brain power every day worrying about, shit, what happens if I lose my key? What happens if the house burns down? What happens if X, Y, and Z? There's all these different things. You're like, imagine if you could just remove all those things and build in the fail safes. So I really think it's going to be an area of growth, is the custody setup, the inheritance planning. I think it's, and there's a few fantastic businesses being built in this space. So to me, I find that area very, very exciting.
Yeah, I do as well. Obviously, Unchained, the sponsor of this show, they've really been spearheading that collaborative custody model. You mentioned Bitcoin Advisors, Peter, and the team there are really focused on this on-ramp, doing something similar. And I think it's only a matter of time because that...
I agree.
As the price goes up, those hardware wallets get very heavy.
That's the thing, right? You don't think about what your coins are. And I've been talking about this a lot recently. People are about to move from the saving proof of work to the oh man, this is now serious. This is now serious money. And, you know, it takes what, two, three cycles? And then you're like, I'm in. I got to protect this now. This is meaningful. So that's kind of the world that people are in. And that's why I think it is going to be a boon in terms of just like giving Bitcoiners a solution that they may not even know that they need, but they might need in 5 years' time.
Yeah. Bit of a tone shift here, but curious if you've seen this in the on-chain data, or maybe you wouldn't see it on the on-chain data, but the Bitcoin existing in this interest rate environment, and maybe not even the interest rate environment specifically, but more in bad economic times. And I think the data is becoming clear here in the U.S., despite what the government is putting out there. And they're saying that jobs data is good, that CPI data is good, but it's becoming abundantly clear that inflation is still a problem. Yes, they've reduced the rate of inflation, but it's still going up higher at 3.3% per year as of last week, and building on higher highs. And then the jobs data, which they're trying to paint as rosy here in the United States, at least, it's becoming abundantly clear that it's good because most people are going and getting second and third jobs, and they're not really going back to their tech jobs. And so do you have a view on Bitcoin in a macroeconomic environment in which you have a global economic slowdown?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually one that I puzzle over quite a bit. And, you know, whilst everything I've said so far, it feels very confident, something that I'm always conscious of is that this is a bloody hard market to read. And even some of the, strangely enough, actually, if I wind back the clock, so 2019 is really where I started getting into this financial plumbing and macro and all that stuff. And I remember back then there was generally like a consensus. All the guys on Macro Voices generally had a pretty similar perspective, and they were contrarian as far as I was concerned. Now, a lot of those guys are on two sides of the fence. Some agree that we're going to have a crack up boom. Some people think that we're going to zero. Like, there's actually a divergence between the contrarians. And I, in a way, that's kind of what a market needs. You kind of need people to be on both sides of the fence. And I think, you know, some of the most qualified people to make this claim are all saying the same thing. It's the hardest market they've ever had to read. So I think that's being humble enough to know that you have absolutely no clue, and just trying to build a longer term thesis. And I think this is another concept. In the short term, and this is why people get chopped up in chop solidation, right? We're going sideways, people get destroyed. It's because people try to apply their long-term thesis to the short term, or vice versa. They apply their short-term thesis to the long term. It's a very clear bias that gets people wrong quite a lot. When I look at as an engineer, if I was to look at things and say, well, what's the cause and effect? The concept of fiscal dominance, I switched onto that pretty quick because I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. If you've got more government spending, yes, we should have a recession. Yes, the stock market should sell off. Yes, a lot of things are very concentrated and very unhealthy. But the government's also spending an absolute boatload of money every day. So like you put those two things together, it's like, well, they might be papering over a lot of the stuff that rationally should happen. But if you look at it from a mechanical perspective, they're juicing so much money in that it doesn't surprise me in any way, shape, or form that we just keep going higher. Now, I did put out a tweet the other day, which again, I have zero edge, none whatsoever in NVIDIA. I haven't looked at a single thing about their books, but I've looked at the chart. I'm like, that looks horrific. That chart looks absolutely ridiculous. And the fact that it's one of, you know, the meme where it's like one guy or a toothpick holding up the whole world. I mean, it's basically holding up the stock market, and the stock, where go the stock market, so go the American economy. And to me, you know, Nick Szabo would say that centralized entities are security holes. That looks like a single point of failure to me. And I don't know anything about the books, but if even somebody believes there's something wrong with the books and that thing starts to fall, then good Lord, who knows what happens then. But what I do know happens then is no matter where that falls, no matter what happens in terms of the recession, no matter what happens in terms of how far down we sell, what are they going to do? They're going to kick that can as hard as they can because no one wants to deal with this problem. Nobody. So the end result, right? Taking my long-term thesis and not applying it to the short term, number go up, right? Corn is going to go up because they don't have an option. They may bandy around and credit to the one thing I found quite interesting. People mock the central bank. They mock the how ridiculous it all is. But they all believe what they say, don't they? Because the jawboning that they're putting into play has people worrying about, I mean, they're worried about so many things, like they're going to kick the can. They have no choice, but they've done a fantastic job at convincing the market that, you know, everything's relatively under control and they're going to manage rates and all this stuff. But I mean, look at this bloody chart. I got no edge, but it looks like a lot of things that generally, you know, what goes up must come down. And it's not so much that it has to come down. The concern that I have is it's the only thing holding everything up. That's the concern, right? That's the problem. And that's really the underlying mechanics in the economy feel very shaky. And you got one superstar, that, you know, the Magnificent One, that's kind of keeping everything together. But maybe the world is just going to bifurcate into a Magnificent One and then a Magnificent Not Much. That could kind of be the way things go, but it's very hard to read.
It is. And you hear so many conflicting narratives within AI, which is arguably holding up NVIDIA and its stock, is this whole hype cycle around artificial intelligence. And is it actually the innovation that Sam Altman and others would have you believe, or is it sort of petering out? And that's something.
And there's also the physical side, right? Like Bitcoin mining, there's a lot of lessons from Bitcoin mining. Yes, people may be using the AI. Do you have the infrastructure to plug those chips in? Or are you going to buy too many chips and they're going to sit on the shelf for 6 months before the actual racking is even developed? There's a whole lot of mechanics that, like, it will only take one of those like worldly constraints to hit to put the brakes on this whole thing. And the concern is that because it's the only thing running, and then if it's the only thing running, it's because everyone owns it. And if it's the only thing everyone owns, it's the only thing everyone can sell. So it becomes this, like, you know, what can go up quickly can come down very quickly, much like Bitcoin in 2021. It goes from 20K to 60K in short order, build no support on the way up. There ain't no support on the way back down.
Yeah. Yeah. With Bitcoin in this scenario, does it become a flight to safety? That's the question I have.
I think the model is that it will suffer like everything else. It will be a liquidity event. Everyone sells off. But it's going to be one of the first to recover because, again, the can kick will come in and people know that Bitcoin's going to be their number one asset to deal with that can kick.
Yeah. I mean, it happened in 2020, right?
Exactly.
Bitcoin fell first, fell hard, then recovered rather quickly.
Yeah. And the other one is that a lot of people are looking at a 2008 or a March 2020. And I would hazard a guess, given that markets rhyme and don't repeat, I would hazard a guess that people looking for 2008 and 2020 probably won't get what they're looking for. It'll look something different. So, you know, it'll be one of those things where people will try and bake the last war and they'll base it on the last war, but that may not be how it plays out.
Yeah. No, you've had the narrative that higher for longer is going to break something structurally behind the scenes. And who knows, that may be manifesting, particularly in commercial real estate markets now, but does that pose a systemic risk to the rest of the season? The rest of the system is yet to be seen.
I mean, the Australian housing market should be falling over right now at 7% mortgage rates because we're all variables. And yet it keeps plugging new highs every single week, plugging new highs. Like, there's other forces at play.
Yeah. We live in interesting times, James.
Oh, yes.
It's thank God we have Bitcoin, though.
What a grounding anchor. Just the intellectual puzzle that it poses. That part alone has kept me so entertained and so intrigued for so long. I love Bitcoin for how much it taught me, way more than university, you know, as much as 8 years in engineering. So it's a powerful tool. And I've said this before, I can't wait for our politicians to own Bitcoin because they might start making some long-term bloody decisions.
Yeah, that's been the most bullish thing here in the United States over the last 8 weeks is the fact that the politicians are being forced to talk about Bitcoin. It seems like they're being forced to be on the side of Bitcoin as well, which is good.
Yes, it's not often the Australians will tune into what's going on over there in America, but I think this could be different because this is a complete circus, but I'm fascinated to see how it plays out.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting 6 months, not even 4 months till the election.
Yes, it is.
I don't think Biden's going to actually make it to the finish line. I think they're going to.
I mean, it's a pretty grim layup. It's funny because like you look at these things and we all see it. It's like, is that really the best guy, like you got 330 million people over there. Can you pick a guy in a suit off the street? Just that guy over there, right? The guy drinking his coffee, run him.
Yeah. You can literally go on the corner of 6th and Congress here and find somebody who'd be a better candidate.
Astounding. I think the framework that I've been looking at is that we're no longer in the world where politicians come from business or from unions or real world experience. They're all career politicians. And, you know, as a result, they just lack the life experience of understanding how these things work, right? They have no understanding. Bitcoin's role in the energy side, which I know you're pretty bullish on, is, in my view, in terms of like a thing that gives me a lot of hope, it's the fact that Bitcoin will be a forcing function, and AI to an extent as well, a forcing function to fixing our energy supply. Because as an Australian, that's what concerns me, is the fact that we are dependent on other nations for our energy supplies. Despite the fact that we produce a stack of natural gas, we don't take anywhere near as much advantage of it as we need, because we keep trying to build windmills and solar panels. And it's like, guys, the sun goes down. Like, at what point do we deal with the problem? The sun goes down. And, you know, supply chain, all that stuff. So that's, I'm super bullish on it, fixing the supply side of things, the energy side.
You guys have a lot of natural gas over there on that island, that prison island that you live on.
Well, the other one is that we've got, so Eric, what's his name, from Macro Voices, he was saying that if Australia, if we look at like oil to Saudi Arabia is Australia to nuclear. We have so much uranium here that we would just, it's like 46% of reserves. And we're not even close to starting that process of actually tapping it. And nuclear power is banned here, which is insane. I'm hoping that we get there, but like, we should be a nuclear superpower in the sense of we have the best engineers, we have the best extraction, we know how to build this stuff when we don't. But that's where Australia should be going. And we're just so far from the mark. In fact, here's a fun fact for you all. There's a north of Sydney, there's a place called Newcastle. It's kind of the second biggest town in New South Wales, and a lot of ports there, a lot of shipping and mining outputs and things. There's been these wind turbine blades for offshore wind that's been sitting on the docks for years, like actually years, just rotting away. And they're now going through a whole process of saying to the public, oh, you know, do we have approval to put these wind turbines up? And people are like, what do you mean? You've already bought them. And they go, well, actually, those wind turbine blades were bought for a different wind project that was inland, but they're so large that they can't fit on the trucks to actually take them out there. So they just, they've bought these wind turbine blades that just sit there on the docks rotting away because they literally can't transport them on the road infrastructure to get them out there. I mean, it's just the most perfect summation of government policy you've ever seen.
Do you have hope that your politicians, or more importantly, the citizens of Australia, will get politicians in place to enact sensible legislation?
I wish I could say yes. There's been obviously events of the last couple of years have concerned me on that front. We don't have a very good crop either. Granted, at least again, you don't trust a politician as far as you can throw them. At least one side is starting to talk about a more pro-nuclear stance. You know, I had a debate with my friends the other day who I disagree with, generally speaking, on these things. And he opposes nuclear because the other party that he doesn't support likes it. I'm like, bro, can we look at things from like a factual Jesus energy? Christ. Can we look at things from an energy perspective, not a blue team, red team? Couldn't separate the two. But, you know, that's part of the challenge.
We really need to break out of this bipartisan framing that dominates the world right now. It's everywhere. You see it happening in Europe right now. These snap elections in France and people freaking out about the transitioning of the parties within the EU parliament. Obviously here in America, it's hyper polarized. That's what they want. They want you, red team versus blue team. Find the other, yell at him. Don't look at all the politicians. Well,
that's what, mate, the orange and white pill. That's what it's all about, because it's, and that's the thing, right? You go to conferences, you meet people within the world of Bitcoin, and you can see behind their eyes that they've done a level of proof of work that most people haven't. They've been through, and actually the tumultuous ride of seeing your net worth dissipate by 75%+ multiple times, that hardens you up, right? So at some point, you've got a bit of grit. You've dealt with some hardship, and that is actually, like, from a character building perspective, there's something about it that just helps you ground in rational thinking. And I just hope that we get to a point where more Bitcoiners get into more positions of decision making, and just slowly but surely the game theory plays out.
Yeah, that's white pill. I'm talking to Turd Demeester about this. If you just look at, as the price goes up, the amount of Bitcoiners that enter the top 0.1% and how much capital they actually control within those wealth brackets, it goes up pretty quickly as the price goes up. And
absolutely,
with that much capital, you can deploy that capital to do things that make the world a better place. And
as you should. And whether that world is the broader world or your own world, I think that's a stigma that I'm a big fan of, is diamond hand as much as you can, but don't not sell because of a narrative. Improve your life. It's your savings and treat it as such.
Yes, completely agree. James, we've got to do this more often.
That's a pleasure.
Pleasure was all mine. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add? Any final thoughts for anybody listening?
Yeah, I mean, Check on Chain's a new venture. I think we're about 10 weeks in to the journey. But checkonchain.com is kind of the new venture. It's a Substack, and there's a charting website, which is all free as well. And, you know, really, I love long form writing. It helps me. I do long form, but also video, because some people like the video side. Some people read, some people do both. But I just love exploring what Bitcoin's doing, right? It's such a fascinating machine under there. And the framework I like to look at it from, in our tagline, we try to be your Bitcoin personal trainer. And the idea is that it can be hard to hodl, right? Is it the top? Is it not the top? And I don't know, but let's try and work it out. And it's about training the reaction function and just being prepared for, like I did a report called Chop Solidation, expect chop solidation. And here we are 2 months later, expect chop solidation, right? It just helps get you in the zone to understanding what is possible, what is probable, and make decisions accordingly.
Yeah, we'll link to Check on Chain, both the charts and the Substack in the show notes. Check it out. I mean, the work that you did for Glassnode was incredible, and I'm really excited to see you branch out on your own and really go after this, because I think, again, like I mentioned earlier, there's multiple times throughout each cycle I'm like, I should probably have a better grasp of this on-chain data so I don't make emotional decisions and can see the broader emotions of the market and make decisions based off of that and not my own monkey brain.
Well, I mean, we also have a masterclass. So each probably 2 weeks, we roll out a piece to just like explore from a very ground level. We're starting with basics. What is the realized cap? What is MVRV? What is SOPA? And just step through these one by one. And then after we finish that, we'll do advanced courses. So there's not only like the market analysis, but we're also teaching people how to use this stuff as well. So, and some people just like to understand, right? Just understand why. And when the market sells off or rips higher, that when they understand why, it makes it easy to hodl. And that's really the goal.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing it. Thank you for joining. Hopefully this is the first of many conversations, because I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to talk about in the future as the market develops.
Absolutely. Well, I'll be in Nashville as well. So if you're floating around, we shake hands, get a beer.
Yeah. See you in person. Absolutely. About a month, a little over a month. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy your Tuesday. I'm going to go enjoy my Monday night. And we'll do this again at some point soon.
Good on you, mate. Been a pleasure.
Peace, love, freaks.